Labrem exercens to his venerable brothers, in the episcopate, to the priests, to the religious families, to the sons and daughters of the Church, and to all men and women, of good will on human work, on the 90th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. Blessing. Venerable brothers and dear sons and daughters, greetings and apostolic blessing. Through work man must earn his daily bread one, and contribute to the continual advance of science and technology, and, above all, to elevating unceasingly the cultural and moral level of the society within which he lives in community with those who belong to the same family, and work means any activity by man, whether manual or intellectual, whatever its nature or circumstances, it means any human activity that can and must be recognized as work, in the midst of all the many activities of which man is capable, and to which he is predisposed by his very nature, by virtue of humanity itself. Man is made to be in the visible universe an image and likeness of God himself too, and he is placed in it in order to subdue the earth 3. From the beginning therefore he is called to work. Work is one of the characteristics that distinguish man from the rest of creatures, whose activity, for sustaining their lives, cannot be called work. Only man is capable of work, and only man works, at the same time by work occupying his existence on earth. Thus work bears a particular mark of man, and of humanity, the mark of a person operating within a community of persons, and this mark decides its interior characteristics, in a sense it constitutes its very nature. Introduction. 1. Human work on the 90th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. Since the 15th of May of the present year was the 90th anniversary of the publication by the great Pope of the Social Question, Leo XIII, of the decisively important encyclical which begins with the words Rerum Novarum, I wish to devote this document to human work, and, even more, to man in the vast context of the reality of work. As I said in the encyclical Redemptor Hominis, published at the beginning of my service, in the See of St. Peter in Rome, man is the primary and fundamental way for the Church for, precisely, because of the inscrutable mystery of redemption in Christ, and so it is necessary to return constantly to this way, and to follow it ever anew in the various aspects in which it shows us all the wealth, and at the same time all the toil of human existence on earth. Work is one of these aspects, a perennial and fundamental one, that is always relevant, and constantly demands renewed attention, and decisive witness. Because fresh questions and problems are always arising, there are always fresh hopes, but also fresh fears and threats, connected with this basic dimension of human existence. Man's life is built up every day from work. From work it derives its specific dignity, but at the same time work contains the unceasing measure of human toil and suffering, and also of the harm and injustice which penetrate deeply into social life within individual nations and on the international level. While it is true that man eats the bread produced by the work of his hands 5, and this means not only the daily bread by which his body keeps alive, but also the bread of science and progress, civilization, and culture, it is also a perennial truth that he eats this bread by the sweat of his face 6, that is to say, not only by personal effort and toil, but also in the midst of many tensions, conflicts, and crises, which, in relationship with the reality of work, disturb the life of individual societies, and also of all humanity. We are celebrating the 90th anniversary of the encyclical Rerum Novarum, on the eve of new developments in technological, economic and political conditions which, according to many experts, will influence the world of work and production no less than the industrial revolution of the last century. There are many factors of a general nature: the widespread introduction of automation into many spheres of production, the increase in the cost of energy and raw materials, the growing realization that the heritage of nature is limited and that it is being intolerably polluted, and the emergence on the political scene of peoples who, after centuries of subjection, are demanding their rightful place among the nations and in international decision-making. These new conditions and demands will require a reordering and adjustment of the structures of the modern economy and of the distribution of work, Unfortunately, for millions of skilled workers, these changes may perhaps mean unemployment, at least for a time, or the need for retraining. They will very probably involve a reduction or a less rapid increase in material well-being for the more developed countries, but they can also bring relief and hope to the millions who today live in conditions of shameful and unworthy poverty. It is not for the Church to analyze scientifically the consequences that these changes may have on human society, but the Church considers it her task always to call attention to the dignity and rights of those who work to condemn situations in which that dignity and those rights are violated, and to help to guide the above-mentioned changes so as to ensure authentic progress by man and society. 2. In the organic development of the Church's social action. It is certainly true that work, as a human issue, is at the very center of the social question, to which, for almost 100 years, since the publication of the above-mentioned encyclical, the Church's teaching and the many undertakings connected with her apostolic mission have been especially directed. The present reflections on work are not intended to follow a different line, but rather to be in organic connection with the whole tradition of this teaching and activity. At the same time, however, I am making them, according to the indication in the Gospel, in order to bring out from the heritage of the Gospel what is new and what is old. 7. Certainly, work is part of what is old as man and his life on earth. Nevertheless, the general situation of men in the modern world, studied and analyzed in its various aspects of geography, culture, and civilization, calls for the discovery of the new meanings of human work. It likewise calls for the formulation of the new tasks that in this sector face each individual, the family, each country, the whole human race, and, finally, the Church herself. During the years that separate us from the publication of the encyclical Rerum Novarum, the social question has not ceased to engage the Church's attention. Evidence of this are the many documents of the Magisterium issued by the popes and by the Second Vatican Council, pronouncements by individual episcopates, and the activity of the various centers of thought and of practical apostolic initiatives, both on the international level and at the level of the local churches. It is difficult to list here in detail all the manifestations of the commitment of the Church and of Christians in the social question, for they are too numerous. As a result of the Council, the main coordinating center in this field is the Pontifical Commission Justice and Peace, which has corresponding bodies within the individual bishops' conferences. The name of this institution is very significant. It indicates that the social question must be dealt with in its whole complex dimension. Commitment to justice must be closely linked with commitment to peace in the modern world. This twofold commitment is certainly supported by the painful experience of the two great world wars, which in the course of the last 90 years have convulsed many European countries, and, at least partially, countries in other continents. It is supported, especially since the Second World War, by the permanent threat of a nuclear war, and the prospect of the terrible self-destruction that emerges from it. If we follow the main line of development of the documents of the Supreme Magisterium of the Church, we find in them an explicit confirmation of precisely such a statement of the question. The key position, as regards the question of world peace, is that of John 23's encyclical Pacem in Terris. However, if one studies the development of the question of social justice, one cannot fail to note that, whereas during the period between Rerum Novarum and Pius XI's Quadragesimo Anno the Church's teaching concentrates mainly on the just solution of the labor question within individual nations, in the next period the Church's teaching widens its horizon to take in the whole world. The disproportionate distribution of wealth and poverty, and the existence of some countries and continents that are developed, and of others that are not, call for a leveling out and for a search for ways to ensure just development for all. This is the direction of the teaching in John 23's encyclical Moderat Magistra, in the pastoral constitution Gaudium et Spes of the Second Vatican Council, and in Paul VI's encyclical Populorum Progressio. This trend of development of the Church's teaching and commitment in the social question exactly corresponds to the objective recognition of the state of affairs. While in the past the class, question was especially highlighted as the center of this issue. In more recent times, it is the world question that is emphasized. Thus, not only the sphere of class is taken into consideration, but also the world sphere of inequality and injustice, and, as a consequence, not only the class dimension, but also the world dimension of the tasks involved in the path towards the achievement of justice in the modern world. A complete analysis of the situation of the world today shows in an even deeper and fuller way the meaning of the previous analysis of social injustices, and it is the meaning that must be given today to efforts to build justice on earth, not concealing thereby unjust structures, but demanding that they be examined and transformed on a more universal scale. 3. The question of work, the key to the social question. In the midst of all these processes, those of the diagnosis of objective social reality, and also those of the Church's teaching, in the sphere of the complex and many-sided social question, the question of human work naturally appears many times. This issue is, in a way, a constant factor both of social life and of the Church's teaching. Furthermore, in this teaching, attention to the question goes back much further than the last 90 years. In fact, the Church's social teaching finds its source in sacred scripture, beginning with the book of Genesis, and especially in the Gospel and the writings of the Apostles. From the beginning, it was part of the Church's teaching, her concept of man and life in society, and, especially, the social morality which she worked out according to the needs of the different ages. This traditional patrimony was then inherited and developed by the teaching of the popes on the modern social question, beginning with the encyclical Rerum Novarum. In this context, study of the question of work, as we have seen, has continually been brought up to date while maintaining that Christian basis of truth which can be called ageless. While in the present document we return to this question once more without, however, any intention of touching on all the topics that concern it, this is not merely in order to gather together and repeat what is already contained in the Church's teaching. It is rather in order to highlight perhaps more than has been done before the fact that human work is a key, probably the essential key, to the whole social question. If we try to see that question really from the point of view of man's good, and if the solution, or rather the gradual solution of the social question, which keeps coming up and becomes ever more complex, must be sought in the direction of making life more human, 8, then the key, namely human work, acquires fundamental and decisive importance. 2. WORKAND man. 4. In the book of Genesis, the Church is convinced that work is a fundamental dimension of man's existence on earth. She is confirmed in this conviction by considering the whole heritage of the many sciences devoted to man: anthropology, paleontology, history, sociology, psychology, and so on. They all seem to bear witness to this reality in an irrefutable way. But the source of the Church's conviction is above all the revealed Word of God, and therefore what is a conviction of the intellect is also a conviction of faith. The reason is that the Church, and it is worthwhile stating it at this point, believes in man. She thinks of man, and addresses herself to him not only in the light of historical experience, not only with the aid of the many methods of scientific knowledge, but in the first place, in the light of the revealed Word of the living God. Relating herself to man, she seeks to express the eternal designs and transcendent destiny which the living God, the Creator and Redeemer, has linked with him. The Church finds in the very first pages of the book of Genesis the source of her conviction that work is a fundamental dimension of human existence on earth. An analysis of these texts makes us aware that they express, sometimes in an archaic way of manifesting thought, the fundamental truths about man. In the context of the mystery of creation itself, these truths are decisive for man from the very beginning, and at the same time they trace out the main lines of his earthly existence, both in the state of original justice, and also after the breaking, caused by sin, of the Creator's original covenant with creation in man. When man, who had been created in the image of God, male and female 9, hears the words, "Be fruitful, and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it," 10, even though these words do not refer directly and explicitly to work, beyond any doubt they indirectly indicate it, as an activity for man to carry out in the world. Indeed, they show its very deepest essence. Man is the image of God, partly through the mandate received from his Creator to subdue, to dominate the earth. In carrying out this mandate, man, every human being, reflects the very action of the Creator of the universe. Work understood as a transitive activity, that is to say, an activity beginning in the human subject and directed towards an external object, presupposes a specific dominion by man over the earth, and in its turn it confirms and develops this dominion. It is clear that the term, the earth, of which the biblical text speaks, is to be understood in the FLRSD place as that fragment of the visible universe that man inhabits. By extension, however, it can be understood as the whole of the visible world insofar as it comes within the range of man's influence and of his striving to satisfy his needs. The expression, subdue the earth, has an immense range. It means all the resources that the earth, and indirectly the visible world, contains, and which, through the conscious activity of man, can be discovered and used for his ends. And so these words, placed at the beginning of the Bible, never cease to be relevant. They embrace equally the past ages of civilization and economy, as also the whole of modern reality, and future phases of development, which are perhaps already to some extent beginning to take shape, though for the most part they are still almost unknown to man, and hidden from him. While people sometimes speak of periods of acceleration in the economic life and civilization of humanity, or of individual nations, linking these periods to the progress of science and technology, and especially to discoveries which are decisive for social and economic life, at the same time it can be said that none of these phenomena of acceleration exceeds the essential content of what was said in that most ancient of biblical texts, as man, through his work, becomes more and more the master of the earth, and, as he confirms his dominion over the visible world, again through his work, he nevertheless remains in every case and at every phase of this process within the Creator's original ordering, and this ordering remains necessarily and indissolubly linked with the fact that man was created, as male and female, in the image of God. This process is, at the same time, universal. It embraces all human beings, every generation, every phase of economic and cultural development, and at the same time it is a process that takes place within each human being, in each conscious human subject. Each and every individual is at the same time embraced by it. Each and every individual, to the proper extent, and in an incalculable number of ways, takes part in the giant process whereby man subdues the earth through his work. 5. Work in the objective sense, technology. This universality and, at the same time, this multiplicity of the process of subduing the earth throw light upon human work, because man's dominion over the earth is achieved in and by means of work. There thus emerges the meaning of work in an objective sense, which finds expression in the various epochs of culture and civilization. Man dominates the earth by the very fact of domesticating animals, rearing them, and obtaining from them the food and clothing he needs, and by the fact of being able to extract various natural resources from the earth and the seas. But man subdues the earth much more when he begins to cultivate it, and then to transform its products, adapting them to his own use. Thus agriculture constitutes through human work a primary field of economic activity and an indispensable factor of production. Industry in its turn will always consist in linking the earth's riches, whether nature's living resources, or the products of agriculture, or the mineral or chemical resources, with man's work, whether physical or intellectual. This is also in a sense true in the sphere of what are called service industries, and also in the sphere of research, pure or applied. In industry and agriculture, man's work has today in many cases ceased to be mainly manual, for the toil of human hands and muscles is aided by more and more highly perfected machinery. Not only in industry but also in agriculture, we are witnessing the transformations made possible by the gradual development of science and technology. Historically speaking, this, taken as a whole, has caused great changes in civilization from the beginning of the industrial era. to the successive phases of development through new technologies, such as the electronics and the microprocessor technology in recent years. While it may seem that in the industrial process it is the machine that works, and man merely supervises it, making it function and keeping it going in various ways, it is also true that for this very reason industrial development provides grounds for re-proposing in new ways the question of human work. Both the original industrialization that gave rise to what is called the worker question and the subsequent industrial and post-industrial changes show in an eloquent manner that, even in the age of ever more mechanized work, the proper subject of work continues to be man. The development of industry and of the various sectors connected with it, even the most modern electronics technology, especially in the fields of miniaturization, communications, and telecommunications, and so forth, shows how vast is the role of technology, that ally of work, that human thought has produced in the interaction between the subject and object of work in the widest sense of the word. Understood in this case not as a capacity or aptitude for work, but rather as a whole set of instruments which man uses in his work, technology is undoubtedly man's ally. It facilitates his work, perfects, accelerates and augments it. It leads to an increase in the quantity of things produced by work, and in many cases improves their quality. However, it is also a fact that, in some instances, technology can cease to be man's ally and become almost his enemy, as when the mechanization of work supplants him, taking away all personal satisfaction and the incentive to creativity and responsibility, when it deprives many workers of their previous employment, or when, through exalting the machine, it reduces man to the status of its slave. If the biblical words, "subdue the earth," addressed to man from the very beginning are understood in the context of the whole modern age, industrial and post-industrial, then they undoubtedly include also a relationship with technology, with the world of machinery which is the fruit of the work of the human intellect, and a historical confirmation of man's dominion over nature. The recent stage of human history, especially that of certain societies, brings a correct affirmation of technology as a basic coefficient of economic progress, but, at the same time, this affirmation has been accompanied by and continues to be accompanied by the raising of essential questions concerning human work in relationship to its subject, which is man. These questions are particularly charged with content and tension of an ethical and unethical and social character. They therefore constitute a continual challenge for institutions of many kinds, for states and governments, for systems and international organizations. They also constitute a challenge for the church. 6. Work in the subjective sense, man as the subject of work. In order to continue our analysis of work, an analysis linked with the word of the Bible telling man that he is to subdue the earth, we must concentrate our attention on work in the subjective sense much more than we did on the objective significance, barely touching upon the vast range of problems known intimately and in detail to scholars in various fields, and also, according to their specializations, to those who work. If the words of the book of Genesis, to which we refer in this analysis of ours, speak of work in the objective sense in an indirect way, they also speak only indirectly of the subject of work, but what they say is very eloquent and is full of great significance. Man has to subdue the earth and dominate it, because as the image of God, he is a person, that is to say, a subjective being capable of acting in a planned and rational way, capable of deciding about himself, and with a tendency to self-realization. As a person, man is therefore the subject of work. As a person he works, he performs various actions belonging to the work process, independently of their objective content. These actions must all serve to realize his humanity, to fulfill the calling to be a person, that is his by reason of his very humanity. The principal truths concerning this theme were recently recalled by the Second Vatican Council in the Constitution Gaudium et Spes, especially in Chapter 1, which is devoted to man's calling. And so this dominion, spoken of in the biblical text being meditated upon here, refers not only to the objective dimension of work, but at the same time introduces us to an understanding of its subjective dimension, understood as a process whereby man and the human race subdue the earth. Work corresponds to this basic biblical concept only when throughout the process man manifests himself and confirms himself as the one who dominates. This dominion, in a certain sense, refers to the subjective dimension even more than to the objective one. This dimension conditions the very ethical nature of work. In fact, there is no doubt that human work has an ethical value of its own, which clearly and directly remain linked to the fact that the one who carries it out is a person, a conscious and free subject, that is to say a subject that decides about himself. This truth, which in a sense constitutes the fundamental and perennial heart of Christian teaching on human work, has had and continues to have primary significance for the formulation of the important social problems characterizing whole ages. The ancient world introduced its own typical differentiation of people into classes according to the type of work done, work which demanded from the worker the exercise of physical strength, the work of muscles and hands, was considered unworthy of freemen, and was therefore given to slaves. By broadening certain aspects that already belonged to the Old Testament, Christianity brought about a fundamental change of ideas in this field, taking the whole content of the gospel message as its point of departure, especially the fact that the one who, while being God, became like us in all things 11 devoted most of the years of his life on earth to manual work at the carpenter's bench. This circumstance constitutes in itself the most eloquent gospel of work, showing that the basis for determining the value of human work is not primarily the kind of work being done, but the fact that the one who is doing it is a person. The sources of the dignity of work are to be sought primarily in the subjective dimension, not in the objective one. Such a concept practically does away with the very basis of the ancient differentiation of people into classes according to the kind of work done. This does not mean that, from the objective point of view, human work cannot and must not be rated and qualified in any way. It only means that the primary basis of TBE value of work is man himself, who is its subject. This leads immediately to a very important conclusion of an ethical nature, however true it may be that man is destined for work and called to it. In the first place, work is for man, and not man for work. Through this conclusion, one rightly comes to recognize the preeminence of the subjective meaning of work over the objective one. Given this way of understanding things, and presupposing that different sorts of work that people do can have greater or lesser objective value, let us try nevertheless to show that each sort is judged above all by the measure of the dignity of the subject of work, that is to say the person, the individual, who carries it out. On the other hand, independently of the work that every man does, and presupposing that this work constitutes a purpose at times a very demanding one of his activity, this purpose does not possess a definitive meaning in itself. In fact, in the final analysis, it is always man who is the purpose of the work, whatever work it is that is done by man, even if the common scale of values rates it as the merest service, as the most monotonous, even the most alienating work. 7. A threat to the right order of values. It is precisely these fundamental affirmations about work that always emerged from the wealth of Christian truth, especially from the very message of the gospel of work, thus creating the basis for a new way of thinking, judging, and acting. In the modern period, from the beginning of the industrial age, the Christian truth about work had to oppose the various trends of materialistic and economistic thought. For certain supporters of such ideas, work was understood and treated as a sort of merchandise that the worker, especially the industrial worker, sells to the employer, who at the same time is the possessor of the capital, that is to say, of all the working tools and means that make production possible. This way of looking at work was widespread, especially in the first half of the 19th century. Since then, explicit expressions of this sort have almost disappeared and have given way to more human ways of thinking about work and evaluating it. The interaction between the worker and the tools and means of production has given rise to the development of various forms of capitalism, parallel with various forms of collectivism, into which other socio-economic elements have entered. As a consequence of new concrete circumstances, of the activity of workers' associations and public cauteritis, and of the emergence of large transnational enterprises, nevertheless, the danger of treating work as a special kind of merchandise or as an impersonal force needed for production, the expression workforce is in fact in common use, always exists, especially when the whole way of looking at the question of economics is marked by the premises of materialistic economism. A systematic opportunity for thinking and evaluating in this way, and in a certain sense a stimulus for doing so, is provided by the quickening process of the development of a one-sidedly materialistic civilization, which gives prime importance to the objective dimension of work, while the subjective dimension, everything in direct or indirect relationship with the subject of work, remains on a secondary level. In all cases of this sort, in every social situation of this type, there is a confusion, or even a reversal of the order laid down from the beginning by the words of the book of Genesis. Man is treated as an instrument of production 12, whereas he alone, independently of the work he does, ought to be treated as the effective subject of work and its true maker and creator. Precisely this reversal of order, whatever the program or name under which it occurs, should rightly be called capitalism, in the sense more fully explained below. Everybody knows that capitalism has a definite historical meaning as a system, an economic and social system, opposed to socialism or communism. But in the light of the analysis of the fundamental reality of the whole economic process first, and foremost of the production structure that work is, it should be recognized that the error of early capitalism can be repeated wherever man is in a way treated on the same level as the whole complex of the material means of production, as an instrument, and not in accordance with the true dignity of his work, that is to say, where he is not treated as subject and maker. And for this very reason, as the true purpose of the whole process of production. This explains why the analysis of human work in the light of the words concerning man's dominion over the earth goes to the very heart of the ethical and social question. This concept should also find a central place in the whole sphere of social and economic policy, both within individual countries and in the wider field of international and intercontinental relationships, particularly with reference to the tensions making themselves felt in the world, not only between East and West, but also between North and South. Both John 23, in the encyclical Moderate Magistrale, and Paul VI in the encyclical Populorum Progressio gave special attention to these dimensions of the modern ethical and social question. 8. Workers' solidarity. When dealing with human work in the fundamental dimension of its subject, that is to say, the human person doing the work, one must make at least a summary evaluation of developments during the 90 years since Rerum Novarum in relation to the subjective dimension of work. Although the subject of work is always the same, that is to say man, nevertheless wide-ranging changes take place in the objective aspect. While one can't say that, by reason of its subject, work is one single thing, one and unrepeatable every time, yet when one takes into consideration its objective directions, one is forced to admit that there exist many works, many different sorts of work. The development of human civilization brings continual enrichment in this field. But at the same time, one cannot fail to note that in the process of this development not only do new forms of work appear, but also others disappear. Even if one accepts that on the whole this is a normal phenomenon, it must still be seen whether certain ethically and socially dangerous irregularities creep in, and to what extent. It was precisely one such wide-ranging anomaly that gave rise in the last century to what has been called the worker question, sometimes described as the proletariat question. This question and the problems connected with it gave rise to a just social reaction and caused the impetuous emergence of a great burst of solidarity between workers, first and foremost industrial workers. The call to solidarity and common action addressed to the workers, especially to those engaged in narrowly specialized, monotonous, and depersonalized work in industrial plants, when the machine tends to dominate man, was important and eloquent from the point of view of social ethics. It was the reaction against the degradation of man as the subject of work, and against the unheard of accompanying exploitation in the field of wages, working conditions, and social security for the worker. This reaction united the working world in a community marked by great solidarity. Following T.L. lines laid down by the encyclical Rerum Novarum and many later documents of the Church's Magisterium, it must be frankly recognized that the reaction against the system of injustice and harm that cried to heaven for vengeance 13 and that weighed heavily upon workers in that period of rapid industrialization was justified from the point of view of social morality. This state of affairs was favored by the liberal socio-political system, which, in accordance with its economistic premises, strengthened and safeguarded economic initiative by the possessors of capital alone, but did not pay sufficient attention to the rights of the workers, on the grounds that human work is solely an instrument of production, and that capital is the basis, efficient factor, and purpose of production. From that time, workers' solidarity, together with a clearer and more committed realization by others of workers' rights, has in many cases brought about profound changes. Various forms of neo-capitalism or collectivism have developed. Various new systems have been thought out. Workers can often share in running businesses and in controlling their productivity, and in fact do so through appropriate associations. They exercise influence over conditions of work and pay, and also over social legislation. But at the same time, various ideological or power systems and new relationships which have arisen at various levels of society have allowed flagrant injustices to persist or have created new ones. On the world level, the development of civilization and of communications has made possible a more complete diagnosis of the living and working conditions of men globally, but it has also revealed other forms of injustice, much more extensive than those which in the last century stimulated unity between workers for particular solidarity in the working world. This is true in countries which have completed a certain process of industrial revolution. It is also true in countries where the main working milieu continues to be agriculture or other similar occupations. Movements of solidarity in the sphere of worker solidarity, that must never mean being closed to dialogue and collaboration with others, can be necessary also with reference to the condition of social groups that were not previously included in such movements, but which, in changing social systems and conditions of living, are undergoing what is in effect proletarianization, or which actually already find themselves in a proletariat situation, one which, even if not yet given that name, in fact deserves it. This can be true of certain categories or groups of the working intelligentsia, especially whenever wider access to education and an ever-increasing number of people with degrees or diplomas in the fields of their cultural preparation are accompanied by a drop in demand for their labor. This unemployment of intellectuals occurs or increases when the education available is not oriented towards the types of employment or service required by the true needs of society, or when there is less demand for work which requires education, at least professional education, and for manual labor, or when it is less well paid. Of course, education in itself is always valuable and an important enrichment of the human person, but in spite of that, proletarianization processes remain possible. For this reason, there must be continued study of the subject of work and of the subject's living conditions. In order to achieve social justice in the various parts of the world, in the various countries, and in the relationships between them, there is a need for ever new movements of solidarity of the workers and with the workers. This solidarity must be present whenever it is called for by the social degrading of the subject of work, by exploitation of the workers, and by the growing areas of poverty and even hunger. The Church is firmly committed to this cause, for she considers it her mission, her service, a proof of her fidelity to Christ, so that she can truly be the Church of the poor. And the poor appear under various forms. They appear in various places, and at various times. In many cases they appear, as a result of the violation of the dignity of human work, either because the opportunities for human work are limited, as a result of the scourge of unemployment, or because a low value is put on work and the rights that flow from it, especially the right to a just wage and to the personal security of the worker and his or her family. 9. Work and personal dignity. Remaining within the context of man as the subject of work, it is now appropriate to touch upon, at least in a summary way, certain problems that more closely define the dignity of human work in that they make it possible to characterize more fully its specific moral value. In doing this, we must always keep in mind the biblical calling to subdue the earth 14, in which is expressed the will of the Creator that work should enable man to achieve that dominion in the visible world that is proper to him. God's fundamental and original intention with regard to man, whom he created in his image and after his likeness 15, was not withdrawn or cancelled out even when man, having broken the original covenant with God, heard the words, "In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread 16. These words refer to the sometimes heavy toil that from then onwards has accompanied human work, but they do not alter the fact that work is the means whereby man achieves that dominion which is proper to him over the visible world by subjecting the earth. Toil is something that is universally known, for it is universally experienced. It is familiar to those doing physical work under sometimes exceptionally laborious conditions. It is familiar not only to agricultural workers who spend long days working the land, which sometimes bears thorns and thistles 17, but also to those who work in mines and quarries, to steel workers at their blast furnaces, to those who work in builders' yards, and in construction work, often in danger of injury or death. It is likewise familiar to those at an intellectual workbench, to scientists, to those who bear the burden of grave responsibility for decisions that will have a vast impact on society. It is familiar to doctors and nurses who spend days and nights at their patients' bedside. It is familiar to women who, sometimes without proper recognition on the part of society and even of their own families, bear the daily burden and responsibility for their homes and the upbringing of their children. It is familiar to all workers, and, since work is a universal calling, it is familiar to everyone. And yet, in spite of all this toil, perhaps, in a sense, because of it, work is a good thing for man. Even though it bears the mark of a bonum arduum, in the terminology of St. Thomas 18, this does not take away the fact that, as such, it is a good thing for man. It is not only good in the sense that it is useful or something to enjoy, it is also good as being something worthy, that is to say, something that corresponds to man's dignity, that expresses this dignity and increases it. If one wishes to define more clearly the ethical meaning of work, it is this truth that one must particularly keep in mind. Work is a good thing for man, a good thing for his humanity, because through work man not only transforms nature, adapting it to his own needs, but he also achieves fulfillment as a human being, and indeed, in a sense, becomes more a human being. Without this consideration, it is impossible to understand the meaning of the virtue of industriousness, and more particularly it is impossible to understand why industriousness should be a virtue, for virtue, as a moral habit, is something whereby man becomes good as man 19. This fact in no way alters our justifiable anxiety that in work, whereby matter gains in nobility, man himself should not experience a lowering of his own dignity 20. Again, it is well known that it is possible to use work in various ways against man, that it is possible to punish man with the system of forced labor in concentration camps, that work can be made into a means for oppressing man, and that in various ways it is possible to exploit human labor, that is to say the worker. All this pleads in favor of the moral obligation to link industriousness as a virtue with the social order of work, which will enable man to become, in work, more a human being, and not be degraded by it, not only because of the wearing out of his physical strength which, at least up to a certain point, is inevitable, but especially through damage to the dignity and subjectivity that are proper to him. 10. work and society, family, and nation. Having thus confirmed the personal dimension of human work, we must go on to the second sphere of values, which is necessarily linked to work. Work constitutes a foundation for the formation of family life, which is a natural right, and something that man is called to. These two spheres of values, one linked to work, and the other consequent on the family nature of human life, must be properly united, and must properly permeate each other. In a way, work is a condition for making it possible to found a family, since the family requires the means of subsistence which man normally gains through work. Work and industriousness also influence the whole process of education in the family, for the very reason that everyone becomes a human being through, among other things, work, and becoming a human being is precisely the main purpose of the whole process of education. Obviously, two aspects of work in a sense come into play here, the one making family life and its upkeep possible, and the other making possible the achievement of the purposes of the family, especially education. Nevertheless, these two aspects of work are linked to one another, and are mutually complementary in various points. It must be remembered and affirmed that the family constitutes one of the most important terms of reference for shaping the social and ethical order of human work. The teaching of the Church has always devoted special attention to this question, and in the present document we shall have to return to it. In fact, the family is simultaneously a community made possible by work, and the first school of work, within the home, for every person. The third sphere of values that emerges from this point of view, that of the subject of work, concerns the great society to which man belongs on the basis of particular cultural and historical links. This society, even when it has not yet taken on the mature form of a nation, is not only the great educator of every man, even though an indirect one, because each individual absorbs within the family the contents and values that go to make up the culture of a given nation. It is also a great historical and social incarnation of the work of all generations. All of this brings it about that man combines his deepest human identity with membership of a nation, and intends his work also to increase the common good developed together with his compatriots, thus realizing that in this way work serves to add to the heritage of the whole human family, of all the people living in the world. These three spheres are always important for human work in its subjective dimension, and this dimension, that is to say, the concrete reality of the worker, takes precedence over the objective dimension. In the subjective dimension there is realized, first of all, that dominion over the world of nature, to which man is called from the beginning according to the words of the book of Genesis, the very process of subduing the earth, that is to say work, is marked in the course of history, and especially in recent centuries, by an immense development of technological means. This is an advantageous and positive phenomenon, on condition that the objective dimension of work does not gain the upper hand over the subjective dimension, depriving man of his dignity and inalienable rights, or reducing them. 3. Conflict between labor and capital and the present phase of history. 11. Dimensions of the conflict. The sketch of the basic problems of work outlined above draws inspiration from the texts at the beginning of the Bible, and in a sense forms the very framework of the Church's teaching, which has remained unchanged throughout the centuries within the context of different historical experiences. However, the experiences preceding and following the publication of the encyclical Rerum Novarum form a background that endows that teaching with particular expressiveness and the eloquence of living relevance. In this analysis, work is seen as a great reality with a fundamental influence on the shaping in a human way of the world that the Creator has entrusted to man. It is a reality closely linked with man as the subject of work and with man's rational activity. In the normal course of events, this reality fills human life and strongly affects its value and meaning. Even when it is accompanied by toil and effort, work is still something good, and so man develops through love for work. This entirely positive and creative, educational and meritorious character of men's work must be the basis for the judgments and decisions being made today in its regard in spheres that include human rights, as is evidenced by the International Declarations on Work and the many labor codes prepared either by the competent legislative institutions in the various countries or by organizations devoting their social or scientific and social activity to the problems of work.